Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Without further ado, I am going to introduce our fantastic guest. Our guest today is Rob Palmer, and he is a fellow Recovering from Religion volunteer. He's a skeptical activist who works to educate the public about critical thinking by contributing to Wikipedia as a part of the Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia project. And he also writes for the Skeptical Inquirer as the well-known skeptic. His column covers contemporary skeptical issues, and he has interviewed conference speakers, podcasters, YouTube scientists, activists, and TV personality as diverse as Cosmos producers, writer Androyan, Thomas Westbrook of Holy Kool-Aid, Seth Anders of The Thinking Atheist, and actor-activist John DeLance. If you don't know who John DeLance is, then you're missing out. He's one of my favorite characters of all of Star Trek. So, Rob, welcome. I'm so glad you're here today.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Well, what are you going to talk to us about today? It's all yours, my friend.
Okay, so today the topic is critical thinking. The first time I talked about a specific subject regarding that, which was, belief in psychics and mediums and what harm could come of that. This is going to be a much more general topic about how to critically think about things. So let's get into it.
If at any time, Rob, you want us to bring out the poll results, just let me know and I'll be happy to do that.
Yeah, I'm actually curious. Let's look at that before we start.
All right, let's do that. All right, so I am sharing the results and I'm going to just read it out for folks on the podcast and in YouTube as well, or folks listening and calling in. Question number one, we have 52%. Most of the folks know how logical fallacies attach to critical thinking. About 35, a little bit, a couple of them not really sure, and six of them are nope, not at all. Most of the people can name a logical fallacy, about 64%, 19% cannot, and 18%, I'm not sure about that. Now, with relating to cognitive biases, 45%, a little bit lower, can understand currently how cognitive biases relate to critical thinking. And when it comes to naming a cognitive biases, 58% yes, 19% no, and 24% I'm not sure.
Okay, very interesting. That's an interesting result. Okay, so this is critical thinking 101. I named it that just because a lot of times a college course will do that, and then you'll get into more depth later on. And most of what I'm talking about today is going to be a very high overview, and certainly you yourself can delve into each of these topics in greater depth, or we can do another presentation here if there's interest. So we're going to say this is inoculating yourself against false beliefs. In the age of COVID and immunization, how to do that. So my background. So I recently retired from a career in aerospace engineering, designing spacecraft and other things that I can't necessarily talk about. In 2016, I joined the GSOW team. We call it sometimes GSOW. It's the Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia team. And I became a skeptical activist. We work on Wikipedia to add science and skeptical ideas and critical thinking and removing pseudoscience and paranormal and conspiracy theory claims, that sort of thing. 2 years later, I was hired as a columnist by Skeptical Inquirer, as Eric said. I write as the well-known skeptic. That's the name of my column. And I've been a speaker at conferences on skeptical topics, including at DragonCon just last week, and twice at the Center for Inquiries Conference, SciCon. And I'm part of the skeptical movement. So we try to educate people about science and scientific skepticism. And you can follow me on Facebook as the well-known skeptic. And I post articles regarding the Skeptical Inquirer, also the work of the GSOW team, and just general items of critical thinking. So since I use that in the title of this presentation, I should define what it is. Critical thinking is the intellectually disciplined process of actively and skillfully conceptualizing, applying, analyzing, synthesizing, and or evaluating information gathered from or generated by observation, experience, reflection, reasoning, or communication as a guide to belief and action. So I've synthesized that down to a more manageable part. I would say it's the objective analysis and evaluation of an issue, not influenced by personal feelings or opinion, done in order to reach a more accurate conclusion. In my opinion, this topic is important because of the following reasons. The human brain evolved on the African savanna, allowing us to survive in the unforgiving environment, but our thinking organ, the brain, which evolved to forestall death until we could raise offspring, right, it's far from perfect. We're primed to trust the opinions and anecdotes of those in close circles, pronouncements of people in authority. We believe things based on personal experience, faulty memory, faulty logic, and a host of cognitive biases. And all of this can lead us to believe things which do not reflect reality, often leading to very bad decisions and harm. And the major point here is understanding these fallibilities is our only hope in overcoming some of the harmful impacts of these limitations. So this is going to be the presentation. There's two main parts. Functional limitation of your brain is the first part, and that's going to cover sensory input errors, data handling limitations. If you look at your brain like a computer, right, it's got a way to get data in it, but then it has to handle the data. And then there's the memory, right? How well does it remember the data that was put in the brain? Then the second large part is reasoning errors. Once all that's in there, okay, it's prone to errors. And because we have cognitive biases and we're prone to fallacious reasoning. So here's the first big part, functional limitations of your brain. So one important aspect of critical thinking, or we'd also say fostering proper scientific skepticism, is understanding the limitations of human perception and memory, right? The functional limitations of your brain. People generally understand that memory isn't perfect, even if they don't realize just how bad it actually is, but they assume your senses, and particularly vision, give us an accurate view of the world around us. This is a common refrain. I know what I saw. When someone is challenged, when they say something that doesn't seem like it's rational, that they couldn't have seen that, I know what I saw. So that being said, this is an important junction right here. I'm going to play something for you, which you have to think about.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
So, I'll assume you want the red pill since you're still here. If you're not here, you can't hear me anymore. You want the truth. And we're going to see how deep the rabbit hole goes. This could cause problems with some people because people don't like to find out that reality isn't as they think it is. That was part of the theme of The Matrix. And Carl Sagan had a wonderful quote about this subject. For me, it is far better to grasp the universe as it really is than persist in a delusion, however satisfying and reassuring. So let's talk about sensory input errors, primarily limitations of vision. So on the left here, and I'll try to describe what I have, even though there's going to be some pictures in this part, especially for the audio podcast and people who are on the phone, perhaps seeing this live. There's a very simplified version of the eyeball, and it's showing that at the back of the eye is something called a fovea. It's the only thing called out. It's a little dimple in the back of the retina, and it's very small compared to the surface area of the eye. And on the right side, there's a graph that shows the accuracy of your vision, where the vertical scale goes from 0 to 1, and 1 is the vision as good as your eye can give you, and it's only 1 at the fovea, and it drops off dramatically, like it just falls off in the whole rest of the eye. And as it's going towards the blind spot, where actually it's 0, it's only at about 20% accurate. And then it falls down to the 0-ish range, just going 40 degrees around away from that little spot, the fovea. So we don't see the world around us in full, or even as it really is. Human vision is unreliable, it's imperfect, and your eyes have flaws that you would not accept in a camera you bought. So as I pointed out in that diagram, you have a blind spot in your retina, which your optic nerve exits, right, to go to the brain. And you see absolutely nothing there. But it's actually much, much worse than that. In the rest of the retina, you only see high resolution in a tiny area in the center of your vision called that fovea. It's only 2 degrees of your visual field. If you hold your arm out and you look at your thumbnail at arm's length, it's just two times that, two times the size of your thumbnail. That's the only part of the whole world you ever see clearly. Also, the fovea is where most of the eye's color sensors are. Outside of that little tiny patch, your vision is mostly actually grayscale. And evidence of this is to support the fovea, approximately half the nerve fibers in the entire retina and optic nerve go from that tiny little spot, and the other half go from the whole rest of your eye's retina. So to summarize that in a nutshell, outside of the fovea, vision is very low resolution. It's mostly shades of gray. You're effectively looking at the world through the tube of a paper towel without any realization of that fact. Well, how can that be? You don't experience the world that way, right? In your field of view, you don't see it that way. You don't notice the blind spot. Well, the brain fools you into thinking everything is perfect in high resolution and in full color. That's why. If a scene is being observed is larger than can be resolved with a stare at that tiny area, then what happens is your eye automatically, subconsciously, is commanded by the brain to shift all around into different positions of the scene sequentially to focus on the fovea. And this fills in the blind spot too, and also improves your color perception for everything around you. So your brain stitches it all together as best it can in the limited time it has to particularly see one thing you're looking at, but it's tricking you. Also, whole nother problem here. Due to the automatic blinking of your eye, that's 10% of the time you're awake. That's quite dramatic, right? Your eyes are sending no useful images to the brain, but the brain edits this out and you never even notice it. If you were watching a movie and the movie was filmed such that every 10 seconds, a full second was black, you couldn't watch the movie, but your whole world is being seen like that by your brain and you just don't know it. Your brain's visual cortex combines all of this less than perfect input to construct a broader view of the world. It presents you with a highly edited and manufactured reality that you experience as perfectly real. But it's actually just a model. It's an approximation of your environment that it's good enough to get by. So, you know, you don't get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger or fall off a cliff is why our eyes work that way. A whole nother issue. There's a lag time between the light hitting your retina and it being processed and understood by the brain. I mean, of course, right? Because it's an electrochemical reaction. It doesn't happen instantaneously. And scientists measure this up to 100 milliseconds, which is a quarter of the time it takes for a 100 mile per hour fastball to leave the pitcher's hand across home plate. It's amazing that any batter can hit a ball. So the reality you visually experience also lags behind actual reality. If something is not clearly seen for a long enough time to get an accurate image, or it's ambiguous, your brain gets confused and it shows you what it thinks it saw. It pulls up images from the past. Oh, it must have been that. Sometimes it's not. This can lead to all sorts of perceptual errors, including optical illusions. So here's a famous one. There's two horizontal lines, and on first look, it looks like the one that's on the top is longer than the one that's on the bottom, but they're exactly the same length. People would look at this and say, how many large triangles are there? Well, you know, there's only one that was drawn. It's got some spaces in it, and the circles around the periphery have space, and that fills in your mind as another triangle, but it's really not there. This is an amazing one. The horizontal bar in the center is the same color from left to right, same shade of gray. Your brain is confused. And this is my favorite one. Eric, can you see that moving?
Damn it, Rob. I can see it moving, but I know that you're going to tell me it's not moving.
This is not a GIF. Damn it. You can do a screen capture and do it in photos and just look at it later. It'll still move. This is not moving. So the amazing thing here is your brain is so confused, it makes it constantly move, and there's nothing moving on the screen.
If I stare at it long enough, I'm going to get dizzy. So
don't. So also, if that's not enough to convince you that your senses don't actually allow you to experience the world as it actually is, then consider this little bit of information. Our eyes only evolved to see a tiny fraction of the entire electromagnetic spectrum. And we know that is right. Roy G. Biv. Everything else is invisible to us, but it's just as real as that tiny portion of the spectrum that we actually can see. Here's a graphical representation of it, right? Almost the whole width of the monitor is the spectrum from high energy photons to low energy photons, which is from narrow wavelengths to long wavelength, from, you know, X-rays to long radio waves, and a tiny, tiny portion in the center is called the visible spectrum, right? Some analysis has shown that that's like 0.005%. But if you actually, the long radio waves go to infinity, so you could say it's almost none of reality that we actually see. It's just because our eyes only can tune into that one frequency, that one small set of frequencies. So some other animals can see portions of that spectrum that we don't, such as snakes seeing an IR or bees seeing ultraviolet. Here is a little video I found talking about the bees.
Flowers sure look pretty to us, but bees see them in a completely different light, literally. Not only do they see the world through these compound eyes made of thousands of individual pixels, they see a world bathed in ultraviolet, way beyond what our eyes can see. We see this, and they see this. See, special pigments absorb the UV light, and they paint this big bullseye in the center of the flower, guiding the bee to the tasty nectar, and of course that sweet, sweet pollination. Now, the relationship between flowers and bees goes way beyond the visual. Scientists from the University of Bristol recently discovered that bees can sense a flower's electric field. Just like when you run across a carpet in your socks, bees build up a positive charge as they buzz through the air, and flowers are slightly negative. This helps pollen jump from the flower onto the bee like electric Velcro, and it also helps the bee figure out if another worker has already visited that flower and slurped up all the sweet goodness. Now, nobody knows quite how the bees sense that electric charge, but their fuzzy little bodies might be buzzing like your hair when you rub a balloon across it. Now, evolution's been playing matchmaker between bees and flowers for millions of years, resulting in one of nature's closest relationships. So next time you see a bee buzzing around the garden on a warm spring afternoon, imagine how their world looks, and think about how much of nature remains invisible unless you see it through the right pair of eyes.
So as was shown there, not only eyes, right? They can sense the static electricity. And there are some animals, I think, birds, I believe, that can like navigate somehow through the Earth's magnetic field, which is just invisible to us. But those things are all real. They're just not real to us. So no species-specific perception of the world is complete or correct, right? It's just a matter of reference. And another point is, even perfectly functioning members of the same species, meaning say your eyes work perfectly, don't have any problems with your eyes. You may not experience the visual reality exactly the same as another person in that situation. I assume most people have heard of dress gate. You know what that is, Eric?
Yeah, that's the gold or
there we go. Don't give it away. Don't give it away.
Oh,
so okay. Yes.
Yes,
that's correct.
Yes, I know what it is.
It's a photograph that became an internet viral phenomenon about 6 years ago. There's actually a Wikipedia article, The Dress, right? Viewers of the image vehemently disagreed about its colors. So Eric remembered the colors he saw it at. That's interesting. So this wasn't just like a silly thing. The phenomenon revealed differences in human color perception, which have been the subject of ongoing scientific investigations into neuroscience and vision science, producing papers published in peer-reviewed scientific journals.
So are you kidding color, me? The dress got yep. a paper?
Yep, a lot of papers. So what color is the dress? I'm going to show it here, and I'd like people to put it in the chat if you're watching this live, or I guess later in the comments if it's on YouTube. What color do you see there? Two colors.
You know, I see now, it's different now, I think. It's, for me, it's blue and yellow, brown?
See, I see white and gold.
You're wrong.
cool. No, you're wrong, Eric.
Worth to report on this. So the first large-scale scientific study of this was published in Current Biology 3 months after it went viral. 1,400 respondents found that, drum roll please, 57% saw the dress as blue and black, 30% as white and gold, 11% as blue and brown, And 2% actually had other ideas about it.
So I'm a part of the 11%. Is that maybe it's because I'm left-handed.
So I'm colorblind. I don't know if they accounted for colorblindness or, you know, actually you're color challenged mostly when you're colorblind. So I don't even know what I see it as. But the real answer is none of these people are right, because the dress has no color, nor does anything else. If that doesn't blow your mind, I don't know what will. Won't. At least it doesn't have any real attribute like volume, weight, temperature, and other real properties of matter. Color is not a thing in the universe. It quite literally is a figment of your imagination. It's just a computation that your brain makes, which enables you to extract meaning from the world. And as you saw, not even every brain even computes it the same way. All right, so this is a quote from a neuroscientist. Color only exists in your head. There's such a thing as light. There's such a thing as energy, but there is no such thing as color. And he actually wrote a paper on the subject about this dress. The dress isn't blue or gold because color doesn't exist. You can look at that up at pbs.org/newshour/science. I used to have a whiteboard up at work where I'd put controversial things, like things people think are true that aren't. This was the most controversial. I had my manager practically screaming at me in email that I'm an idiot. Color is real. So I've discussed the visual system, but our other senses, such as hearing, also have limitations. Some animals' brains, in fact, use, you know, things other than vision for the primary method of understanding the world, sonar, echolocation. So they have an entirely different perception. They have a different map of reality in their brains than we do. Does a bat's brain map surface texture as color? Maybe. I mean, since color really isn't a thing, it's possible. And again, not all members of one species can agree on reality. Remember Yanni versus Laurel? Okay, so what do you guys hear? Put it in the chat.
Laurel. I hear Laurel.
Laurel.
I hear Yanni, yeah. Clearly. And my wife had never heard this before. And yesterday when I played this as a test, she goes, why are you playing Laurel, Laurel, Laurel? I said, no, it's not Laurel, it's Yanni.
Laurel. Laurel. Laurel.
I actually remember when this first happened, we were in a public area in my workspace, and somebody said, I can't believe this. People are saying people are saying it's Laurel. I hear Yanni. And everyone else, for some reason, around him heard the other. And he thought they were all pulling his leg and making fun of him. He was going to start a war. So we're going to go on to the next topic, which is data handling limitations. So now that this information is been received by your brain incorrectly, now it's data and it has to be handled by your brain. And since the brain isn't perfect, there are also problems there, right? Your brain ignores much of what the eyes and other senses send it, in fact. This is a problem of attention limitations of your brain. I mean, if you're driving in a car, you're looking for certain things, you're not reading all the signs that are going by, you're not watching things on, say it's a divided highway on the other side, you can't do that. Your processor cannot handle that data. It can only handle the data at a given rate. So much of what happens around you is ignored, meaning it's not even seen or it's not remembered. There's two kind of flavors of this that have been quantified. One is inattentional blindness. This is failure to observe visible objects in a scene when your attention is distracted, right? They're rendered effectively invisible to you. There was a basketball passing counting study, which we'll see shortly. Change blindness is slightly different. This is the failure to notice changes in a scene as they happen. Not everything is deemed equally important for the brain to remember in detail. So in fact, much of it is ignored. So I'm going to play a short video here.
The monkey business illusion. Count how many times the players wearing white pass the ball.
For those who can't see it, there's three people with the black shirts and three with white, and the white people are passing the balls back and forth, and the people in black are passing it back and forth on a little stage with a curtain behind them. They're walking in circles as they do this, and hopefully you're counting the times the balls are going back and forth. And they're done, and they're walking off the stage.
The correct answer is 16 passes. Did you spot the gorilla? For people who haven't seen or heard about a video like this before, about half missed the gorilla. If you knew about the gorilla, you probably saw it. But did you notice the curtain changing color or the player on the black team leaving the game? Let's rewind and watch it again. Here comes the gorilla, and there goes a player, and the curtain is changing from red to gold. When you're looking for a gorilla, you often miss other unexpected events. And that's the monkey business illusion. Learn more about this illusion and the original gorilla experiment at theinvisiblegorilla.com.
So I had seen the original gorilla experiment when that went viral. And so therefore, of course, I saw the gorilla walking across the screen now. I wonder if anyone hadn't seen it yet or didn't notice that. But the funny thing is, the way they portrayed this, they kind of tricked you. There were two other things, as he showed you later, the person walking off the screen and the color of the whole background changing. And I did not notice either of those. I wonder how, you know, people here took that.
And there's a lot of folks in the chat, and some had seen it before, but they still missed the curtain change, and others missed both of them totally. It's very effective in making your point.
Yeah, it's amazing. So now, once this processing problem is understood, now we have to talk about memory, right? So you got the inputs from your sensory apparatus, your vision or other senses into your brain. The data is not totally handled exactly right. So now there's the issue of, what do you remember about it? Right, so the second part to the refrain, I know what I saw, is I remember like it was yesterday, right? You can't tell me I'm wrong. I remember it like it was yesterday. So human memory is imperfect and unreliable. A brain is not an organic recording and playback system. Can you accurately remember what something you have repeatedly seen, like a dollar bill looks like? If I had time, I'd say, hey, take out a piece of paper and a pencil and draw it. Maybe on YouTube, people can do that and stop the video here. But this is commonly what's drawn. So it's a simple rectangle. The person did ones in each of the corners. There's a circle with a person in the center. It says $1 in big print on it, and God We Trust below the person. So if you look at a real bill next to it, like almost everything is wrong, except there's a person in the circle, they're pointing the wrong way. There are four ones on the corner, that's correct, but all the other details are wrong. So here's an automobile logo that people see all the time. And again, people were asked to draw it from memory. Practically nobody got it even close. There are a few that maybe aren't too bad, but that of course is the Volkswagen logo. I mean, one person actually wrote the word Volkswagen across a circle. It's like, nope, right? Here's another car company. So, I would ask you to guess what this is, but two people wrote the word Toyota across, and no, they don't write the word Toyota. Their emblem looks like that. There's one that looks pretty close, but most of them are just horrible, including big red capital T and the peace sign for some reason.
One looks like a pig wearing a face mask.
Which one's that? Which one's the pig wearing a face mask?
The next to the Easter egg with the Toyota underneath.
Well, that's pareidolia. So we're going to talk about that next.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you're going to.
Very good. All right. Memory malfunctions. So the brain retrieves bits of information from past experiences. In this case, like what it thinks you saw when you looked at a bill, every time you ever looked at a bill. It stitches them together, it fills in the gaps, and it tells you a cohesive story, which to you is perceived as accurate and reliable memory of reality. So really interesting TV show, Brain Games, had numerous episodes about these problems with the brain. One that I remember, I think, so of course, take this with a grain of salt, but it was a group of people that were waiting to go into a building. They had signed up to be tested, and they didn't know what the test was going to be. But they were told, well, we're still waiting on the room. Let's hang out here. And they're standing on a street corner. Well, what happened was they staged a robbery right in front of them. It was a purse snatching. And I think there were multiple people involved in grabbing the purse and throwing it back and forth. The woman was shoved. And then it's revealed, oh, okay, don't worry, that wasn't real. That's the experiment. And then they were all taken separately and interviewed about what they saw. They all had different stories, right? Not only that, the more sure somebody was about that they had the right story, the more likely they were wrong. And there was a plant amongst them. It was somebody who was told to try to make them tweak their stories. So like someone might have been sure that the victim was wearing a white dress. She said, no, it was yellow. It was definitely yellow. That got the person to say, oh yeah, you're right, it was yellow. And then she was sure it was a yellow dress, just as sure she was before it was white. I talked about psychics in my last presentation to RF4X, and this is a big thing that they take advantage of, right? People don't have good memories about what's said in a reading. They misremember the details. A common thing like that is the medium will say to the sitter, okay, your grandfather is here. He's trying to communicate with you. He's wearing some kind of uniform. Was he in the Air Force or the Army or the Marines? Or maybe he worked for the U.S. Postal Service. And she goes, no, wait a minute. He worked for UPS. And she goes, oh, yeah. Okay, yes, I see he's got a UPS uniform on. So later on, when the woman leaves, she'll tell all of her friends, I don't know how she did it. She knew my grandfather worked for UPS. She will not remember all of those other questions that were just wrong. So the work of Elizabeth Loftus is very important. She's a cognitive psychologist and an expert on human memory. She has written many books on the subject. She provides eyewitness testimony as an expert in criminal cases. And luckily, I got to interview her for the Skeptic Zone at PsyCon, and I'm going to play a little bit of it.
Just ran into Elizabeth Loftus, and she's going to be a speaker at the conference. Right now, she's signing an autograph of witness for the defense for Ed Baer.
There you go.
And now I'm going to ask her.
Thanks for your help, Ed.
My pleasure.
So thanks for doing this interview.
And, sure. I'm glad we could do it conveniently.
What is your presentation going to be about?
Well, it's called The Fiction of Memory, and it's about research that I and other psychologists have done on how it is that people come to believe and remember that they did things or saw things that they didn't do or see. How do people develop false beliefs and false memories?
So does that include when someone maybe misremembers something, so there actually was an event, but they don't remember it properly?
Well, that's part of the work.
Okay.
And many of the experiments that I've done show how easy it is to change people's memory for an event that they actually did see. But what's even more stunning is when we can plant an entire event in the minds of people for something that didn't happen.
Wow. Give me an example.
Well, make them believe that they were lost in a shopping mall and frightened and crying, or that they were attacked by an animal, or they witnessed a person being demonically possessed.
Yeah, in her presentation, as I recall, she told the story of the people who were participating in this. They had their family had supplied family photos of them as children, and sometimes they were photoshopped by the experimenters. So they would take the family and put them in a hot air balloon, and when the subject of this test was a child, and they would show them, do you remember this? Do you remember this vacation where you went on a hot air balloon ride with your parents? Vaguely. And they would keep asking them questions, and they would come up with all these details of something which never happened in their lives. It's quite amazing. So given all that science has revealed about how poorly we see, how poorly we remember ordinary things, it makes no sense to trust anyone's memory of what they remember. They say they remember as an extraordinary or supernatural event, whether they say it happened decades ago, last year, last month, or even a minute ago, right? There's this very famous quote attributed to Carl Sagan, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And as should be obvious now, that any claim based exclusively on human senses and memory does not come close to qualifying as extraordinary evidence. So all about this summarized is what we tend to think is, I know what I saw, I remember it perfectly. But the actual reality is, this is a quote by neurologist Oliver Sacks, every act of perception is to some degree an act of creation, and every act of memory is to some degree an act of imagination. So now we're going to go to the second subject, reasoning errors, right? Everything I've discussed to this point concerns physiological failings with the design of the human body, the eyes, the brain, all that sort of thing. These flaws are due to how we evolved. They can't be fixed. The only thing that you can do is understand their limitations when making decisions about what to think and believe based on them. Now I'm going to discuss things that you can, to some regard, change, right? Because they involve how you process, think about the faulty data that your brain has collected through your unreliable senses and placed in its unreliable memory. So unfortunately, the thinking process or reasoning is also less than perfect, right? But unlike the uncontrollable physiological flaws, you're at least partially in control of how you process this problematic data. You can change how you think and reason. But we need to understand the flaws in the reasoning to know what we can work on changing, all right? So the rest of this talk is going to concern two categories of such flaws, cognitive biases and logical fallacies. So first up, cognitive biases. What is that? Most of you were familiar with it, I think, from the poll. Let's go into it. It's a heuristic, which is a fancy computer word for shortcut in thinking. It's a shortcut, right? It influences how we make decisions about what to believe. Your brain couldn't possibly try to calculate from scratch what to do about every single thing that it comes in contact with. It has these shortcuts, like what did I do before? What's similar to this? I'll do what I did before, that sort of thing. These shortcuts result from your brain's effort to simplify an incredibly complex world with too much data for it to handle. Cognitive biases sometimes lead to perceptual distortions, inaccurate judgments, illogical interpretations, or what is broadly called irrationality. Although these biases are unconscious, if we understand them, we can train our minds to use a different pattern of thinking and mitigate the effects on our belief and behavior. All right, that's the point of this last part here, to understand what these things are so we could avoid falling victim to them. So confirmation bias, I look at this as the mother of all biases. It's a tendency to search for, interpret, favor, and recall information in a way that confirms or supports one's prior beliefs or values, right? Any disconfirming information is not sought. And when it's come across or offered by someone else, it's ignored or discounted without the proper consideration. Can you think of any examples of that, Eric?
One of the big things that comes to mind is just racism in general or anti-Semitism in general, like all Jews are horrible. And so if you're a Jew, even though you do some amazing things for the community, you're still a horrible person because anti-Semitism. But that's a horrible, rough thing to bring up right now, but that's what's coming to my mind. There's those heuristics.
Anyone else want to offer one?
Also too, like on the opposite end, like the no true Scotsman fallacy, like you're not a true this or you're not true that based on your own preconception of what that other group is. And if you have this bias of how a certain group behaves, you're going to throw out that no true Scotsman fallacy to confirm your own bias.
Good. So nobody's going to go to the whole COVID and vaccine thing, which is in the news every freaking hour?
Well, I could have, but I was okay. Trying to be different.
All right, well, I'm going to go there. I mean, that's the thing, right? Your friends have convinced you because you've seen Facebook posts that they're dangerous. And then your other friend, no, it's not dangerous. This is like, safe. Hundreds of millions of people, almost billions in the world have gotten it. People are not dropping dead. And it prevents illness. And they go, I'm not looking at that. There we go.
We got in the chat, someone has mentioned creationism and the whole website Answers in Genesis, where they take the Bible must be true and therefore we're going to discount any other evidence and try to explain it away or just toss it out in general.
Certainly an example. And in conjunction with that, I would say that specific one is the next one I'm going to talk about, motivated reasoning.
Yeah, there we go.
So this is which produces beliefs, justifications, or decisions that are desired, rather than those that accurately reflect the evidence or situation. Yes, Answers in Genesis, right? They have a motivation to prove what they're saying, and therefore they're going to twist everything to fit that. In the corporate world, I have seen this, examples of this kind of a thing, right? You can picture somebody who gets a huge bonus for suggesting the company spend millions of dollars, and I have witnessed this, to change the way something is done, to improve a process, right? And then a year later, and they were told this is going to increase productivity by 100%. So then they do some studies to try to see if that worked. Well, if the guy who got the bonus and looked like a hero for suggesting it, is in charge of doing that study. What do you think he's going to find? I mean, I made a mistake. Sorry. No.
Yeah.
They're motivated to look at the data in a certain way to prove what they already want to be proved.
I had a gentleman I was doing some research on who was a meteorologist, and he's a big climate denier. And I was looking at some of his papers and the motivated reasoning behind that, and just watching the 99.99% of other climate scientists tearing that to crap. And just so, but he continues to put out this climate denialism.
Yeah, that's a big stuff. One. Not wanting to admit you were wrong for a long period of time. And by the way, this is a cult thing, right? This is why people will go to the edge or further and kill themselves in a cult. Because you don't want to admit you sold your house and you gave your wife to the cult leader and it's not true, right?
Yeah, I remember Heaven's Gate happening with the late 90s or something like that.
Yep. All right. So another one, status quo bias. This is a tendency to have a preference for the current state of affairs, right? The current status quo, the baseline, is taken as a reference point. And any change from the baseline is perceived as being bad, perhaps without any real rationale for that. That's a big thing in pretty much every society.
This sounds like traditions to me.
Yep.
Dead people peer pressuring you to do the same thing that they did.
It's worked for all these years. Why would we change it now?
Right. Yeah. So that's partly this one, the bandwagon effect, right? The tendency for people to adopt certain behavior styles or beliefs simply because others have them. And in fact, the rate of uptake of these sorts of things tends to increase with respect to the population that also believes it. The bandwagon effect. Now jump on the bandwagon, right? This is due to wanting to fit in with your peers, not to be an outsider. And kind of contrary to this, there are some people who go the other way. There's something called the reverse bandwagon effect, known as the snob effect. So it's a different cognitive biases that actually causes people to avoid doing something or even believing something because others do, which is a little weird. But I would say more people, fall for the bandwagon effect than the opposite. And this is sort of connected, outcome bias, right? The tendency to evaluate a decision on the basis of its outcome rather than on the factor which led to the decision. To give a medical example, which I took for my own here, a doctor decides to give a critically ill child an experimental medication that has a 50% chance of curing the condition. If the child survives, the doctor is praised for being a hero. If the other side of the 50% is right and the child dies, the doctor's criticized harshly for his bad mistake for not doing something else. Selection bias occurs when proper randomization is not achieved in a set of individuals, groups, or data selected for analysis. That sounds very sciencey, but it could just be you're going to look around at your friends and only select the ones that you think fit the criteria that you're trying to believe. Right? And that will often lead to false conclusions. Like, I don't know, everyone who's a part of my religion is happy because my three friends are happy. You didn't look at enough people to make that decision. What's that?
Would prayer fit into this? Or do you feel I prayed and so it came about?
We have a one that's closer for that later. It's actually dead on for that. Priming effect. So you might say believing that prayer works could be this. This occurs when an individual's exposure to a certain stimulus influences their response to a subsequent stimulus without any awareness of the connection, right? These stimuli are often related to words or images that people see during their day-to-day lives. So I think of this as, you're a young person in a church that does speaking in tongues, and all the adults around you are doing that. And it comes to your time and age when you're supposed to be able to do it. Well, you're going to do it. You've been primed to believe this should happen. Now, this is a difficult one to avoid because of the way we subconsciously process this kind of information. But we can develop an awareness of how it affects us in the hope of mitigating the most harmful parts of it. Something called the illusory superiority bias. This involves a person overestimating their own qualities and abilities in relation to the same qualities and abilities of other people. Right? Without self-awareness of metacognition, people cannot objectively evaluate how good they are at whatever they do. Now, this came up actually, I think it was in the last presentation here, maybe 2 weeks ago. The Dunning-Kruger effect was called out because it adds the claim that people with high ability underestimate their own competence. And the Dunning-Kruger effect attempts to explain both of these biases. But I have to say the Dunning-Kruger effect has been challenged by later analysis and studies, and the Wikipedia article is quite fascinating on that subject. And as we mentioned before, there's pareidolia, right? Your brain is primed to understand certain things. And so when it sees something, it doesn't really know what it is. It might tell you that's what it is. So what do you see there, Eric or Helen?
What do I see there? I see, well, initially just I think I see an angel. I was trying to think of something goofy, but
yeah, there
it looks
you go.
Like an angel to me.
I see someone wearing like a kimono dancing, like, but ooh, something. So that's what I see. So,
cool. So clear. Assuming this wasn't photoshopped, you can never tell these days. Yeah. You know, it just happened to be an odd arrangement of clouds with the sun behind it. Here's another odd arrangement of clouds. I see the one on the right as maybe King Kong fighting a beast that just knocked down. But you can.
Oh, no, I can't not see it.
You know, I see Godzilla.
That is the other thing.
So I see Godzilla.
One is that, oh, Godzilla. Oh, I don't see
it. Yeah, I just watched a bunch of Godzilla movies this weekend, so my brain's probably already there.
All right, and what creatures on the left are just defeated?
Isn't there like a turtle?
Yes.
Or
kaiju?
Yes. So here's another cloud image that just happens to look, I don't know, not religious per se, but interesting. Definitely a face.
It's like a feather to me.
So yeah. This one's near and dear to my heart. Everyone know what this is called?
This is on Mars. I don't know the
it is
space
called
on
the
Mars.
The face on Mars. It's called the face on Mars. There are countless books that were written about this because when this was first photographed in 1976 by Viking 1, and sent to Earth, and you know, after all the footage was gone by and this was published, somebody found it in the archives. And oh my God, there's a civilization on Mars. And the larger picture of this area has other features. I could see a little bit of craters and whatever there. They were identified as smashed buildings. This is like in the city, the cities on Mars. I think that's the name of the book. It's amazing. But really, this is what it looks like. 20 years later, another orbiter took a picture with different sun angle and a much higher resolution. And nobody would have said that's a face the first time they saw it. And there they are side by side. So yeah, in the first case, there was a certain sun angle.
I can see the sun angle.
The nostril is just an artifact. There are dots all over that picture, you see. Those are flaws in the camera. And you know, so that definitely added to it.
You know, I think what happened, Rob, is that the Martians got wind that we caught one of their cities and they went and just changed it.
You read the book. That's what the book claims.
Oh, was it?
Was it in the book?
I'm making that up, but I'm sure it is. Oh. Right? That has to be the apologetic. They went and filed the whole thing down because now we could see it. So, yeah. So there's two pictures of toast here. Or actually, one on the left is toast and one on the right is grilled cheese. And sort of human faces in the burn pattern on it.
Didn't they sell these pieces of food for like ungodly amounts of
money? There we go. Goldenpalace.com, the Virgin Mary grilled cheese. Somebody is making money on this.
It reminds me in St. Peter was a Clearwater, like a few years ago, the glass building that showed the image of the Virgin Mary on the, it was all along the windows Clearwater.
One.
So.
Chicken church.
Can anybody not see a chicken there?
I see a surprise chicken. Like, why are all these people coming into my back end?
One more picture. So this I imagine somebody cutting open you know, this and say, oh, I'm not eating that. That's not going in my salad. It's a pepper, I think. And it's just horrible faces.
These are the episodes of VeggieTales that they don't put out.
All right, so that's the end of the biases, but we're going to talk about overcoming them. So to do that, you have to question what you accept is true, base your beliefs on facts, verify the data sources you're using to come to conclusions, avoid knee-jerk reactions when you hear or see things, keep an open mind, check for alternate explanations and contrary opinions, and that means check outside your echo chamber. All right, the last section is on fallacious reasoning. These are informal logical fallacies.
What skeptical thinking boils down to is the means to construct and to understand a reasoned argument and, especially important, to recognize a fallacious or fraudulent argument. The question is not whether we like the conclusion that emerges out of a train of reasoning, but whether the conclusion follows from the premise or starting point, and whether that premise is true.
And I would also add to that whether the conclusion is true. So that audio, by the way, was from Carl Sagan's book, The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. And it is an amazing book. So what is an informal logical fallacy? Let's first start with what a fallacy is. A fallacy is the use of an invalid or otherwise faulty reasoning in the construction of an argument. It could be an argument you're making to yourself, by the way, because you want to, you know, think a certain way, or it could be really made as an argument to someone else. Fallacies are commonly divided into formal and informal. A formal fallacy is a flaw in the structure of a deductive argument, which renders the argument invalid. This would be if A equals B and B equals C, then if you say A does not equal C, that would just be wrong, right? That would, you're trying to make a formal argument there, and it would be a formal fallacy. But we're going to talk about informal fallacies. These contain errors in reasoning other than that use of an improper logical form. They're composed of mistakes in reasoning that arise from mishandling of the content of the propositions that are part of the argument. And a fallacious argument of either type can be deceptive by appearing to be better than it really is and making a point and proving your case when it actually does not. One of the ones I hear probably the most often is the appeal to popularity. This is an argument that concludes that a proposition must be true because many or even most people believe it. Oh, and I hired an assistant to read examples for each of these cases.
Christianity is the most popular religion on earth with billions of followers, so it must be true.
I've heard that for several religions, as a matter of fact, that claim. Anyone else want to come up with another thing that maybe isn't even about religion for appeal to popularity?
Oh, like Toyotas are GMs are the best cars because they're made in America.
Yeah,
because it's a bias against America. Everybody, there's a lot of GMs on the road.
the one I always think of is alternative medicine claims.
Yeah, that one,
right?
Too. Yeah.
Right. All my friends use homeopathy, or they go to an acupuncturist, so yeah. It has to work.
Got it.
Right. So, as Eric mentioned, appeal to tradition. An argument which makes the claim that something is true or beneficial simply because it has been believed or practiced for a long time. And here is an example.
Hinduism is the oldest religion and has been around for thousands of years, so it must be the one true faith.
So I used a different religion there, but I actually had a friend of mine use the first one and this one together in one sentence to make a double fallacy for proving Christianity was real. She said, "Oh, Rob, Christianity has to be real because billions of people have believed it for thousands of years." And I just did a facepalm. Because to someone who says that, they don't realize they're being illogical, and it's a fallacy at all. Argument from ignorance. This is an argument that assumes a conclusion based primarily on lack of evidence of the contrary position.
No one can actually prove that God exists. Therefore, God does not exist.
So that would be the strong atheist position if you're making a fallacy. That's a fallacious argument, right? It doesn't work in either direction. The theistic position might be no one can actually prove that God does not exist, so therefore he does. Argument from personal incredulity. This is a special case of the previous one, argument from ignorance. It's a fallacy of concluding that because you can't understand it or believe it, then it must not be true.
It makes no sense that something as complex as the brain could have evolved. Therefore, an intelligent designer must have made it.
And I had a friend
that same argument for like eyeballs and
Yep. Look at love. The trees. This is look at the trees.
Yes. I had a Jehovah's Witness say that to me. How do you explain the trees and the nature all around you? Like,
yep. Yeah, it's literally, if you don't have an understanding of what we don't understand everything as humans. Science hasn't uncovered everything, and they probably never will. But there are things we fairly well understand. And then you hear something like that, and it just sounds ridiculous if you understand how, you know, frankly, dumb it is. Shifting the burden of proof. This is a special case also of the argument from ignorance. This fallacy is putting the burden of proof on the person who denies or questions the assertion being made.
I believe there's a shiny teapot, too small to be detected, orbiting the sun between Earth and Mars. Because you can't prove this wrong, you must agree that the teapot is there.
So that is a special formulation called Russell's Teapot by philosopher Bertrand Russell. And clearly this, you know, it has a religious connotation, right? You know, I believe my God is out there. You can't prove me wrong. So therefore you have to agree with me that he is there and exists. So here's a real world example of where this happened. As I mentioned, I work on the Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia project. And this was one of the articles that we work on and maintain and put proper information on. David Politis is a conspiratorialist. He made up his own conspiracy. It's called Missing 411. There's a large series of books he wrote. I think it's up to 10 on the subject. Basically that he says people have disappeared in national parks and elsewhere, and it's mysterious. There's no good reason, and the government is hushing it up. But the current article has scientific analysis of that, which we added. It says, while data analysis suggests that these disappearances are not statistically mysterious or unexpected. So a fan of David came along and changed it to say, and this is awful grammar, these analysts don't prove any prods, I think he meant proofs, these analysts don't provide any proofs that the missing persons have not gone under normal circumstances. That makes my head hurt. I think
that's high quality editing there.
Yeah, high quality editing. I think basically he said, nah, you didn't prove he was wrong, so he's right. I mean, that's what basically he was trying to make that point, right? Right. So he was shifting the burden of proof there. So, of course, you know, it's actually back to that situation now.
Oh, so what the statement said was like, all right, so nobody has really proved him wrong, so you have to kind of prove him wrong before he, and until then, he's right.
That is correct. That's right. Right. And in fact, they did prove him wrong. They looked at the data, you know, from a scientific perspective and said, you're just making up shit. I mean, this data doesn't show that at all. All right. Anecdotal evidence. This is a big one. Tendency to attribute unwarranted credibility to your own observations or to the testimony of individuals we know and trust. And especially that now we understand how faulty all that could be. Why would you do that?
Scientists say that empirical research proves that prayer has no noticeable effects. But I know that God answers my prayers because it happens every single day. Plus, others from my temple tell me God answers their prayers too.
So there we go. Personal anecdotal information and of your friends outweighs the fact that we've tested this and it's just shown to be BS.
I hear the same thing with when it comes to acupuncture and naturopathy as well.
Absolutely. How could scientists claim they did test it? It doesn't work. I know it works.
And the talk you gave on psychics seems to fit pretty absolutely. Well into this as well.
Absolutely. No one can prove it, right? And the controlled scientific, but nope, I heard it. They you know, they told me something they couldn't have known otherwise, so it's real. Yep. So I avoided the Latin names for most of these. Most of them have Latin names, but this one's just too cool and everyone has to memorize this. Post hoc ergo propter hoc. It's Latin for after this, therefore, because of this. See, post hoc ergo propter hoc is easier to say than that. It's a fallacious argument that asserts that because two events occurred in succession, one after the other, the first event was the cause of the second.
I prayed for a new job. And then the next week I saw a posting for one. Less than a month later, I am employed. Allahu Akbar.
There we go. That's the thing with prayer, right? And if it doesn't work, it's the confirmation bias, motivated reasoning, you just forget about it. But if something happens after you prayed about it, then it happened because you prayed about it.
Again, this feels very similar to when folks were talking about acupuncture or natural too.
Absolutely. All alternative medicine, you know, claims of efficacy is based on this, right? You got a horrible headache. You took some homeopathic preparation, which is literally water. Your headache went away. Oh, yeah, went away because it took that homeopathic medication. It works.
Or you're just dehydrated.
Yep. Or your headache would have went away by itself. Or maybe you also took an Advil and you don't want to mention that, right? That happens a lot too. Yeah, this is a huge one. People, and it's the brain tendency to see patterns, not only in clouds, but in data. This happened, then this happened. Therefore, it's connected, right? It's you know, correlation does not equal causation is the way it's said in science. Another thing is appeal to authority. An argument which grounds a claim in the belief of a source that is not authoritative. The source may be non-authoritative for many reasons, including having no expertise in the relevant field or being at odds with the scientific consensus on this issue. I mean, this happens a lot with these fringe people. There are fringe doctors. There's an organization called America's Frontline Doctors, which was created by Simone Gold to fight the idea that vaccination could stop COVID. And people listen to her as an authority. I mean, she actually is an MD, but she's a whack job.
Our minister preaches that the only way to beat cancer is to be healed by the Spirit of God. He has a Master's of Divinity, so I'm stopping my chemotherapy.
And unfortunately, people do that too. Another example of this is Dr. Oz, right? He's a cardiac surgeon, got his TV show, and he sells all sorts of stuff that is just alternative medicine stuff with no proven efficacy. And per my previous topic, psychics, he's had psychics on his show, and he just says, hey, these people are all psychic. And he's an MD. And so therefore, people who, you know, give him authority, they give him authority of pronouncing that psychic abilities are real.
Now, I hear this sometimes thrown back on me when I'm having discussions with folks. Well, you're just appealing to the scientists or this group of scientists. Isn't that an authority? You're appealing to authority right there when you're trying to prove your point.
Yeah, so that's going contrary to the last part of that description, being at odds with the scientific consensus. I mean, the only way we can understand something being real is a scientific consensus on a subject. Now, there's a very slight chance that could be wrong and that could be changed later, but it's the best we have. There's a famous quotation, and I forget who said it, but it's something like, science is what we have invented for us to stop fooling ourselves.
And I do like the part in here where it says, where it has like a source that's not authoritative. Like that seems pretty clear. Like when I normally think of the appeal to authority, it's just like, hey, if you're appealing to someone higher or, you know, who has some authority, like a pastor or a president or something. But when you have this part authoritative in there and in the relevant field and at odds with scientific consensus, that makes it totally clear for me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the important distinction. Yeah, and the example that I gave is you know, the person who's got no relevant expertise in medicine, and you know, basically he's giving medical advice. And unfortunately, you know, this happens all the time. And at least in the United States, it's hard to stop it. I mean, there are laws about practicing medicine without a license, but there are, you know, psychic healers and mystics, and Gwyneth Paltrow promotes Anthony William, who's a medical medium. You know, she, as I mentioned last time in the presentation, I think, you know, she gives him all praise that he's the most amazing healer there is on the planet, because he gets his information from his spirit that tells you what's wrong with you and what you need to take to fix your medical issues. Circular reasoning, right? This is a big one. It's sometimes referred to, often you'll hear it as, that's begging the question. This occurs when the conclusion of an argument is used to support the premise. It's a big circle without any other evidence being presented.
The Bible is true because it says it is. It's all right there in the Holy Scriptures. How can you not see that?
I like when callers call in with that to the atheist experience. But it applies to the world outside the religious realm also. Appeal to consequences. This fallacy concludes that a belief is either true or false based on whether it leads to the stated desirable or undesirable consequence.
If evolution is true, it means we are just like dirty apes. What a horrible thought. So I believe mankind was specially created by God in his own image.
So I hear this one a lot in political circles too, right? We can't make some law or change the way something happens because of X, Y, and Z is going to happen, whether or not that really will happen. And, you know, I don't want that to happen. Right? Anything popping into your heads about this one? No? Okay, we'll go on with it.
Yeah, for what, yeah. Some reason, just going blank on it. I mean, I can totally get it, but I can't think of a second.
Oh, it might have to, you know, immigration, you know, we have to have these policies because we don't want, because if you let too many people in the country, this is going to be how they're going to vote later or something.
If we take vaccines, we're losing our freedom.
Yeah, possibly, possibly. Yep. And then there's the big one, appeal to emotion. Right. As the name says, it's characterized by manipulation of emotions in order to win an argument or prove a point, especially in the absence of any valid supporting evidence.
Think of all the children without faith. They must be miserable. How can their lives have any meaning? You must raise them to believe in Jehovah.
Right. In a corporate environment, I've heard, we have to make this change because, you know, if we don't, the other companies are going to do better than us and we're going to really, you know, we're going to be in a bad situation. Do you want to be in a bad situation? Yeah, but you haven't even proved to me that what you're saying is going to work. Straw man fallacy. I love this one. Occurs when someone gives the impression of successfully refuting an argument while actually misrepresenting their argument. All right. One who does this is said to be attacking a straw man. I believe this comes from like a scarecrow is a straw man. And if you're going to do bayonet practice in the field to see that you know how to stick somebody with a bayonet in war, they put straw men up, right? And it's practice, but you're not really fighting an opponent that can fight back. So you're attacking a straw man, a weaker version of the reality.
The theory of evolution is wrong because all life on Earth could not have come about by random chance. It would be like a tornado going through a junkyard and assembling a working 747.
So somebody want to mention what's wrong with that argument there? Why is it a straw man?
But this could actually happen given billions and billions of years. I think that the time, you know, for me,
that is one thing, absolutely. Right?
It's like what
happens in seconds, right?
It's like the monkeys, infinite amount of monkeys, right, typing on, being on typewriters that eventually they'll come up with the works of Shakespeare.
Right,
it,
right.
It could eventually happen.
Right, a million tornadoes going through an infinite number of them. But the most problematic there is evolution. The theory of evolution is not random chance.
Yeah.
Okay.
So actually, if you research it, when Darwin came up with it, evolution was actually believed before. They just didn't know how it worked. It was already come to the conclusion that animals had come from other animals, but they all thought it was God-directed, right? And in fact, that's the position of the Catholic Church now, right? But the thing is, you know, fundamentalists deny it's true at all, that animals don't come from other species. They were all just specially created. But the theory of evolution as Darwin constructed it is that it gave a method, a mechanism, right? Natural selection. Sexual preferences and selection. It's not random chance. Part of it is random chance, it's gene mutation, but it just is throwing out the very important part to make this argument. And by the way, I had a friend tell me that. I remember from memory, that's what she said. And then one day I was listening to the Atheist Experience and someone else called in with that. So it must be preached from the pulpit because, you know, very odd coincidence to have exactly the same construction. You know, it wasn't a 737 or 707, it was a 747. And it wasn't that it went through a junkyard and made a Studebaker, you know, or a Ferrari. No, it was a 747. Non sequitur. This basically means it doesn't follow. So many other name fallacies are really just varieties of this one. This is a general term, right? You commit this when what's presented as a conclusion does not logically follow from the premise at all.
Believing in Jesus makes me feel good, so I know that he died for my sins and is the prophesied savior.
Right? The first part before the comma has nothing at all to do with the second. He could have died for your sins and made a prophesied savior, but the proof of that is not because you believe in him and you feel good. False dichotomy. This is an argument in which two choices are presented as being the only possibilities, when in fact there are one or more additional options. And I'm getting towards the end, by the way.
A rational person should live as though God exists. If God does not exist, such a person will have only a finite loss, some pleasures, etc. Whereas if God does exist, they stand to receive infinite gains, and they avoid infinite losses.
So that is known as Pascal's wager. This comes up a lot on the helpline. This was from 17th century French theologian Blaise Pascal. Of course, there's a problem there. There's a lot of problems with it. The one that I like to point out is the false dichotomy part of Pascal's wager, right? To the Christian, maybe Catholic, Blaise Pascal, the only possibility was that God was Yahweh, right? The God of the Old Testament and the New Testament. So either Yahweh exists or he doesn't exist. There was no thought about any other possibility. I find it intriguing that the writers of a modern sitcom were more intelligent than Blaise Pascal.
Tell it, Daddy.
And what if we pick the wrong religion? Every week we're just making God madder and madder.
Testify!
Clearly Marge is a Blaise Pascal fan. So what I hope you got from this whole presentation, due to our flawed senses, computational limitations, and less than perfect memory, what you think you remember experiencing must always be suspect. This is also true for claims made by others to you, right? And this is especially true for extraordinary claims of any type, those which contradict what science has uncovered and tell us about the nature of reality. Our natural thinking process is flawed in a lot of ways. It's heavily influenced by cognitive biases, and it's easily subject to fallacious reasoning. But by understanding these facts, we can inoculate ourselves from harm. Bottom line, understanding our fallibilities and altering those that we can, by critical thinking, will lead to holding truer beliefs and to making better decisions. And I'm going to leave you with the words of Carl Sagan on these fallibilities.
Science is more than a body of knowledge. It's a way of thinking. A way of skeptically interrogating the universe with a fine understanding of human fallibility. If we are not able to ask skeptical questions, to interrogate those who tell us mm-hmm. that something is true, to be skeptical of those in authority, then we're up for grabs for the next charlatan, political or religious, who comes ambling along.
Thank you for your attention.
Rob, thank you very much. Oh, that was fantastic. What we have got here, we have one question that I have for you. We hear about folks who seem to have perfect memory. Like you can ask them, like, what did you have for lunch 15 years ago? How does that play into the research that Elizabeth Loftus and others have done when by implanting false memories? Can false memories be implanted into those so-called super memory folks?
That's a very good question, and I don't know. That's never come up in anything I researched, and it didn't come up in Loftus's presentation. And I do remember reading some articles about people who claim to have that kind of memory, and Jennifer Aniston pops into my head for some reason. I don't know if that's a bad memory on my part.
We have Mary Lou Henner here on the... in the chat was the
yes yes question. Yes okay maybe that's what Mary I was Lou thinking Henner. Of my memory failed there. Yes, I do remember that from Taxi. Yep.
Yeah.
I recall reading some articles that some people actually are much better at doing that kind of thing, but it's a tiny fraction of humans. But yeah, I don't know the official answer to that.
So my kind of question would be, like, what would your advice be to people to kind of catch their own biases, you know, how to become like fully conscious that, you know, what you think may be true or what feels right may not be true. And like how, what's a good way as a skeptic to kind of suss through that stuff?
Yeah, well, so one thing that helped me was when I started to research this stuff, I started to just, you know, look at the videos that have been made by people who are established YouTubers who do this kind of research and present it to the public. And much of it is informative. When you see this talked about frequently, it kind of gets into your head and you remember it more easily when it actually comes up in your own life. And there's certainly tons of books on the subject also. So one book that I think is going to go into the resource selection, but I have to recommend it, is called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. It's by the hosts of a podcast of the same name. It came out maybe 2 years ago, but it is a fantastic book on critical thinking and skepticism, just generally.
I got it in my bookshelf.
There you go.
Are you showing it off?
I'm showing it off. I think they even signed it for me somewhere, but it's a fantastic
book. So yes. I actually have a signed version too, and it's one of my prized possessions. I actually did, they were a book review of that for a Skeptical Inquirer. And then I got when that was published, I got all five rogues to sign it. So that's on my wall behind me, which you can't see because I got a Zoom background. So yeah, I found that book one of the best at consolidating all of the stuff that they say on their podcast for like 15 years, like into one easily digestible book.
Well, we have another question here too. Can you recommend any online teaching materials for how to develop critical? I know you mentioned this book, and this is a fantastic book to do that, but we also deal with media literacy too. How to identify when we're being played by a news channel or network or something like that.
Yeah, so the Great Courses Plus has something by Dr. Stephen Novella, and I'm actually going to Google it right now because I listened to it quite a long time ago. Your Deceptive Mind, Critical Thinking, The Great Courses. I actually stream that for free with like a 30-day free trial or something. So if you don't have, you can probably do that. And it's maybe 7-8 episodes, and he takes you through all these points at much longer length than I did here. And he's a neurologist, and he's the head of the New England Skeptical Society and the host of, he wrote that book, and he's the head of the main host for the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. So he knows of what he speaks.
Do you have any data on like how often people succumb to logical fallacies? Do you have any any data like that? Because my kind of reading of this is thinking like everybody succumbs to it. But it just
I would guess, and I don't have data, but I would guess everyone does to some degree, especially. So cognitive biases, I didn't really talk about this, but cognitive biases and logical fallacies play together, right? I mean, you have a way you want to think, and then what, you know, the construction of your argument is called a logical fallacy, but it's, you're creating it that way because you have a cognitive bias that wants it to be a certain way, right? So yeah, and everyone has biases. I have biases, everyone has biases. And it is a hard thing to make yourself realize that when it's you and to get out of it. But the more you study this stuff, the more you realize that we're all susceptible to this kind of thinking, the better you are at working your way out of the things. I mean, the worst thing is, no, as I started, I know what I saw, I know what I remember, you know, there's nothing you can change about what you tell me. And unfortunately, I have a friend that was like that. And interacting with her a lot, which is one of the things that got me into being a skeptical activist. She had a huge Facebook following that would support everything she would say, and she believed in every woo crackpot thing there was. And, you know, one example was she had a near-death experience at young teenage years, and she's like in her late 50s when we were having this conversation. She goes, no, Rob, I know what I saw in that near-death experience. You can't convince me I'm wrong. I remember it perfectly. It's like, okay, if you tell me I can't convince you, what can I tell you? So her mind was closed. You know, the points that I made about how you fight your cognitive biases, she would not have any of that. She didn't want to talk to anyone outside of her echo chamber. She believed what she believed, and she saw what she saw, and she knew what she knew. And that's the biggest problem, I think, with pretty much everyone, you know, in the world believing the wrong things. If you can get yourself to the point where maybe I'm not right about this, and then look into the opposite opinion, you know, that's the first step.
It seems like this, yes, we could use this presentation to perhaps identify fallacies in other folks, but I feel, maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like the point here is really to help us identify it in ourselves, and so that we can kind of work to live maybe a more...
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I entitled my thing, you know, inoculating yourself against false beliefs. Right.
Yeah.
It's easier to notice it Although if you don't know about any of this, you're not going to notice it in other people either. But even if you know about them, it's easier to notice other people making mistakes than if you do the same thing, right? And that's one of the big things. I mean, it's a terrible strategy when you're arguing with somebody to say, oh, that's the no truth gospel fallacy. And then try, no, you know, but you can, like with street epistemology, well, why would you believe that? And then guide them to say that they made an illogical, you know, a connection of evidence and it's just not right. Whereas when you're doing it in your own head, it's perhaps not so easy to realize you're doing it, but at least by knowing these things are possible and exposing yourself to the fact that that is the way things are, you could possibly help yourself, you know, think better. And, you know, I used to believe in, you know, Ouija boards and biorhythms and UFOs abduct aliens and UFOs abducting people when I was a teenager. And somehow when I found the skeptical movement and started reading Skeptical Inquirer in my late teens or early 20s, you know, it became evident to me that, oh, I'm not thinking about this correctly. And this is another way to think about this information. And that, like, you know, in a fairly short turn, did a whole 180 degrees on the way I thought about things. So yeah, I will have to put out another source there since I write for the magazine now, Skeptical Inquirer. Skeptical Inquirer has a paid subscription for the magazine and it would certainly appreciate it if you do that. I think it comes out four times a year, but there is an online version which I write for and there are tons of articles, sometimes multiple ones in a week, sometimes multiple ones in a day. So Skeptical Inquirer online, you could find it. My column, just type the well-known skeptic, Skeptical Inquirer, Rob Palmer, Skeptical Inquirer. And from there, you can find all the other columns. And there are people who look into, you know, ghost claims. There are people who look into alien claims. There are people who talk about general perceptual errors, like I talked about tonight. All sorts of things there that can help anyone think more rationally.
Helen, we got one last time for one last question. Do you want to take it?
Sure, I can do that. So is it ever too early to expose kids to this precious information? Is there a risk they may become disillusioned? Or on the other side, is the whole point for them to become illusioned?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the official answer to that is. I offhand can't see any detriment to giving people the correct information. One of the things that is really bad about falling into these traps in life, it becomes part of you. And, you know, most of us have experience with this. Once you personify something as part of your personality, it's much harder to change an opinion on it than if that never happens in the first place. Like, you know, the perfect, I'm not saying anyone is this, but the perfect scientist would have a belief in something because of evidence and data. And then evidence comes to change that. And I go, oh, you're right. Now I believe that. I mean, right. That's the opposite of religion. I'll just say that, right. Cause religion is supposed to be inerrant and unchanging, at least in a short term, clearly over thousands of years, you know, things morph, but it's like, the point is not to make change. The point is they have truth with a capital T, where science has a truth as best we know it with a small T, you know, as best we understand the universe. So I think if you're exposed to that early on, you know, that's much better than absorbing into your mind and the way you think things that are just false, because then it's very hard. There's a line which is attributed to Mark Twain that I like and I've used in other presentations. It says, it is much easier to fool somebody than to convince them that they have been fooled, right? Mm. So if you get them first and you teach them what they need to know so they don't get fooled, you don't have to try to go through that to unfool them.
Yeah, I can definitely, like, raising kids that are now atheists and teaching them to be skeptical and to, you know, to question things that are just presented to them without any evidence. Like if you can't go try to find the answer yourself and someone's trying to sell you, you know, a piece of shit and telling you it's a diamond, you know, you better make sure that it's, you know, you should have that doubt. If something in your brain is giving you pause, listen to that voice.
Right, right. As a quote from Carl Sagan in his last published interview, you know, he said, if you have this flawed way of thinking, you're just open to the next charlatan.
He said, exactly.
He gave two examples, religious or it was another word, I forget, who comes Amazon along. You know, religion's one thing, but clearly political is another, right? You're just going to believe anything that a politician says, regardless of whether or not there are any facts behind it, or in fact, it's contrary to the facts. And clearly it also applies to, you know, the field of medicine, that people believe these nonsensical people who say, you know, crystals will heal you of your cancer. And that's life and death sometimes.
Yeah. Rob, thank you so much for this presentation. I know I, for one, I've said this with several of the RFRXs, but this one I'm going to have to watch again and again, because it was just got some fantastic information in it. And I want to become a better person. That's actually selfishly one of the reasons why I wanted to get this RFRX thing started well over a year ago, to learn about this kind of stuff. And I'm really, really grateful that you brought this to the table and helped educate.
You're quite welcome. Lou, actually, who works for CFI, posted in the chat. I'm not familiar with the quote. He says, Richard Feynman, who was a Nobel Prize winner in physics, said, the first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool. That last part is for sure true.
Rob, before we move on and close this out, I'll give you the last word. Do you have anything you wanted to say that we didn't cover?
Well, I'm just very thankful that you gave me the platform to try to put this out there, and hopefully it was helpful to people.
Yeah. Thank you. I can see in the chat that a lot of people are really responding positively to it. So thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. This was wonderful.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There, you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days, and now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the Volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.